people react the best to price incentives.
Yeah.
So making the more durable, more sustainable stuff more of cheaper,
yeah,
that would really help.
And that's not the approach because it puts all the responsibility on the consumers.
Yeah.
So what can companies do more to solve this problem?
Hey there, and welcome to Money for Change, the podcast where we discuss current developments and the role of money in creating a more balanced and just world. Of course, we want you to be part of this conversation. Head over to our website via the link in the show notes to share your thoughts or ask questions. Let's get started. Hello there, and thanks for tuning in to another episode of Money for Change. My name is Emma DeLeo, and I am your host for today. Today, we are going to go back in time a little bit, back to October 14th, 2025. Whoa, not that far.
Not that long ago, yeah.
Specifically that day, it's Microsoft. We all, I think, know Microsoft here. They decided to end the free Windows 10 support. And this was on the same day as International E-Waste Day, International Electronic Waste Day. What this in practicality means is around 400 million computers still using Windows 10. I think we're on Windows 11 currently.
Windows 11.
Yeah. And about half of those won't be able to upgrade to Windows 11 because of the hardware. There was a lot of uproar about this when we first wrote it. They were still going to have it go, but now Microsoft has caved to pressure, so power to the people, and extended this by 1 year. We're going to be discussing this in detail, and joining us today is Mattia Kajic, sustainability researcher at Triodos Bank, and of course, Hans Stegeman, our chief economist and director of impact and economics. Welcome.
Thank you, Emma.
Thank you.
So the key question for today, how does shortening the device lifespans, also known as planned obsolescence, affect consumers, businesses, and the environment? And a big question already is, what is planned obsolescence? Mattia, can you explain a little bit?
Oh, of course I can. So planned obsolescence is basically when producers intentionally make a certain product have a limited useful life. And what that means is that the product can go on being used, but the producers are putting pressure to have it fall out of fashion or fall out of technical use. This can be in maybe a social way first. So if you imagine you have your new phone, you have your new laptop, and you're really committed because you're under a budget to stay with it for as long as possible. And first, in the next year, you notice that there are certain apps that you can't use because they're not supported, or your friends are sharing certain, I don't know, new digital tools that your device doesn't support. So that's immediately to start with the social pressure. Then you've got the software pressure, you've got the updates, and your device is no longer so usable because it starts to get slower, laggy. And then after that, you've got the hardware pressures. So again, it's no longer supporting these new softwares, but also, you know, I don't know, the battery starts to lag. You want to change it, but it's not possible. You go to your repair store and they're not able to open it. There's no parts available, you know. So you've got really this three-step process of how it's eventually being phased out. So no matter how committed you are to your phone and keeping it, eventually it goes into this early obsolescence and it's no longer usable.
In economic terms, we have the difference between economic lifespan and technical lifespan. So the technical lifespan is the length the product at least can do what he is supposed to do.
Yep.
And the economic part is what you told. And as part from this planned way, there's also a more obscure planned way, and it's marketing and advertising. So influencing what you call the social pressure, but also intentionally influencing it. So bringing new models, fancier stuff, or new features that everybody wants to have of the product itself without it really the case. And there's also sometimes a challenge that you don't see the difference between innovation and obsolescence and planned obsolescence.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have very quick innovations like 10, 15 years ago with mobile phones, when you saw every 1-2 years, everybody wanted to have a new phone because you had extra features and it really improved a lot.
Yeah. So let's do a practical example. I remember being in high school and you had your flip phones and you had the texting with the numbers and all that. And then we got, in Canada at least, you had the Blackberries or the iPhones. You had your own messaging service. Internet browsing was definitely not a thing yet. And then within, I think, 5 years, you got...
Yeah.
The Instagram, the Facebook on the phones, and that is...
And in such a phase, it's very hard to see the difference between planned obsolescence and technical obsolescence. And it's very important to understand that in most cases, also nowadays, when it is planned obsolescence, most companies use the same argument as technical obsolescence. Mm, yeah. Yeah, but like Microsoft saying, yeah, this is no longer to be used because we have much better products and why should we sustain it? So that's very, and maybe interesting, we have a colleague, Yuri, who has a car, a very old car. What was it? How old was it?
It was from 1997, this car.
And you can say he's a consumer with a different taste. So, and the car broke down when he was on holiday in France. Yep. And then he had a problem because he valued the car. He wanted the car and he was happy with all the dysfunctionalities of the car. However, the insurance company did not want to repatriate the car to
when
the Netherlands. And then you have a difference of the economic lifetime of the car where the insurer says, yeah, but it's not that much value, that car. With his personal preference, Yuri really liked the car because his drum kit could fit in the trunk, I believe. And that's where you have the difference that you see that the system makes it impossible to lengthen the lifetime of products, even if you, as a person who has that product, wants to have it.
And the product technically works. It works. Because that's another question I had when we were discussing this topic. Is this really an issue? And so I went a little bit and I looked online and I have this graph in front of me. And actually there's a European Environmental Agency, they did a study on it. And it looks like certain products are actually going up in terms of lifespan. A car being one of those. I think household goods is another one. And the issue here really is the electronic waste. So I think we need to put the emphasis on the fact that this is really an issue for electronics and that it doesn't reflect all other products, like a car from 1997. I think that's
But
really
I do think that you can still see this early obsolescence or planned obsolescence in other areas. And it might be even more visible, going to Hans's earlier point. Like if we look at something like fashion, you can see that those seams are not in there anymore. Yeah. Like that these clothes really disintegrate in the first wash. Like that quality that goes into making the product is not there. And we see that also, I think, on the graph for clothing, that it's an issue as well.
Yeah.
And more visible. But I think today we should still focus on the technical aspect.
And I think in this one graph, you see the consumption of clothes in 2020 just plummet down below for, I think, for Corona.
Everybody was in sweatpants.
Nice. Okay, so this is an issue. It's really focused on the electronic waste aspect. It's partly to do with technological aspects, also the economic point. Mattia, what does this mean for society? What are the impacts?
Yeah, I think it's really important to go back to the impacts that you were listing around Microsoft, because it's which computers are still running Windows 10. We might think, oh, my computer runs Windows 11. It's not that big of a deal. But actually around half of the computers that use Windows, around half of them are still on Windows 10. So for all of those consumers, Microsoft has decided you no longer have access to this.
Yeah.
You know? So it's really an access issue. And you can either buy a new computer or you can start paying for this service. But you already paid for the service when you bought the product.
Exactly.
So this is really where all the access conversations come in. And I promised myself that I wouldn't refer to too many studies in this podcast episode. But I know that there's one from Wisconsin-Madison University where they found that for a U.S. household, it's around 1,000 additional U.S. dollars that households have to put forward because of technological obsolescence. So that's only for technological products, $1,000 per year additional that they are paying for these technological products.
And to be very clear, that's for products or services that still work.
Yeah.
But because of an upgrade, an update, they cannot be used anymore.
Exactly. The consumers might have wanted to keep using them. Yeah. The product itself is able to be used, but for some other alternative reason, be it marketing or the software update, it is no longer used.
Yeah, and this is the cost part for society, but there's also a waste part for society, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is the part that's usually closest to my heart. Like there's so many, first of all, you have so much waste. So I think you already mentioned it in the intro, something like 700 million kilograms of waste from these 400 million computers that are going to become obsolete. And that waste, first of all, could have been avoided, but we also need to think about the impacts that are all across the supply chain, right? So all of those carbon footprint from the extraction of the materials, from the production process, like there's a lot of labor and resources that went into the production of those products. And instead of trying to extract all the value and reuse them maximally again, we are not doing that, but we are on this constant cycle of marketing and new, consume. So.
Yeah. Because Microsoft arguably could have also introduced this update and this reduction in services also with a side program. Well, hand in your old computer that doesn't work anymore and you can have a 50% off or however much.
Or keep using for a longer time the service that you have. And if you want to support our innovation and, you know, invest in our innovation, then buy a new computer if you want to try the Windows 11 or whatever they have coming up.
They're very passionate about this.
I'm sorry. I'll run back.
No, that's very good. But
Well, it's infuriating.
Well, not sorry.
Yeah.
No, but if you look from a societal perspective, it's value destruction, though, right?
Yeah.
That's what you said. So instead of capturing the value from all that has been created and where it's consumer demand, because people wanted to have that stuff and don't want to spend extra money, we simply destroy it.
Yeah.
So we don't use products or services that are still there, and it becomes waste because there's most of the time no other way than being waste. And that's, useless.
But we've here really highlighted the consumer aspects of it and the environmental aspects, but it's also a cost to the businesses, right? Like they could find a way to get those Microsoft laptops back, as you said, and then find a way to extract those resources and use them again, because then that's cobalt and gold and whatever else that they don't need to buy new.
Yeah.
But instead that is also going to waste. So it's a cost.
Yeah, I think they have thought about it. But most of the price is the intangibles, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the software and the intellectual property rights, etc., is not the materials itself.
Yeah.
So probably there's no business case
for
taking it back, or the business case for plant obsolescence is better.
Is better, yeah.
And I think they're smart people. So they have really thought
They've
about
it. They've looked into it. Yeah, it's not a neglected area.
Definitely.
But I mean, I just want to get back to this because you would think that there's something better coming. This Windows 11 versus Windows 10, I don't know the difference. But, you know, is this really a reflection of a new and better technology about progress and innovation?
Not always. I think that's also what we see with the iPhone, with Apple. So the technological change has become really incremental.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But hey, it's part of the business model. So it still serves their interests to let it go away, to plan obsolescence, because then the volume will be higher of the newly sold products. And especially so when the quality change is only incremental. Because who wants to buy a new product if the change is so small?
Yeah.
I think that's also what we see at a lot of stuff. So when you over the fast increasing speed of innovation, when you really need to have or really want to have a new product because it's obviously better, then after that phase, when you also don't know if it's planned obsolescence or real innovation, but if people want to buy it, it's very clear. But after that phase, you have as a producer, you have an incentive to make sure that consumers are going to buy that new product and need to buy that new product, because otherwise you don't make the profit.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is it's that addiction to growth and the wider perspective.
I didn't want to mention it, but it's
inevitable. It's so apparent here. Yeah.
No, and that's simply how it works, right? So if you have a company and you have a profit objective, which you normally have, and you have shareholders who expect you to make profit, then you do everything what is hopefully only what legal is, but what's in your power to increase your turnover. That's the goal.
Mm-hmm. But to go back to your point earlier here, is there not also an incentive for other types of innovation? Or you will also likely say that they've thought about that and then decided that it's not as good as this planned obsolescence. But for example, if they are innovating for modularity, you know, so that instead of having to replace the whole laptop when they have a new software, you can just exchange a part that now supports this new Windows 11, if we're staying with the Microsoft example.
Yeah, there are, of course, models. I think it could be a model, for instance, for Apple, that you say, okay, how do we get loyal customers?
Yeah.
To make sure that they always use, let's say, and you have that kind of examples, that you get a kind of lock-in to one product, but that you can modularly replace parts of it or upgrade it, and you still have to pay extra, of course.
Yeah.
But then you can also make a business model. And there are some examples, I think, of that.
Of course, but why is a Fairphone a kind of example not interesting for Apple? Because I think they could, I mean, Fairphone really had to build all the way up from the start, whereas Apple already has a lot of this in place and they could more easily integrate some of these ideas and innovation and maybe do a better job of it even.
And because the material costs are a relatively small part of the total cost. So what would help is have higher costs for materials. Mm-hmm. Then it becomes better in terms of the business case to capture them and to hold them and to build your business case.
Costs for materials also means higher costs for products.
It's already astronomical, right, for Apple.
But then the business case to capture them is also better.
Yeah.
So from a very practical, I think then of course there should be changed more in the economy, but only if you talk from the angle of a producer, then it helps the business case. That was your question to have a non-planned obsolescence, but to capture everything, then it helps if your resources, if your materials are more expensive.
And what about things like, what if they had Microsoft or Apple repair shops all over, instead of going down this planned obsolescence route where they want to get rid of them as quickly as possible, wouldn't it also bring a lot of economic incentive to them if they had an alternative, more repair or, some other business model there?
Like I said, they're smart people.
Yeah.
But they do something differently. Yeah. So you can sell back your own phone and get a discount on your new phone and then still use it. I think that's what they more or less. But then you have to buy a new product. Mm-hmm. They want you to buy a new product, so they use everything that is in circularity landscape useful to get you to buy the new product. Mm-hmm. So they're very smart too. And then they have the materials, they have it back, but then still you need to buy the new phone.
Yeah.
That's how they build it.
And I think it's a wider paradigm in our economy where you produce a product and then you sell the product and that's it. There's no more ownership of the company to determine how it's discarded, how it's used even.
Yeah, you sell it and you don't think about it anymore.
Exactly. Yep. So I think that shows that wider shift. I think two things, the focus on the financials. So only measuring success in how much money has been made, how much products sell for. But then that second one is also the responsibility after the product has been sold, not to figure out the rest. That's a societal thing. We don't do, there's no ownership there.
Yeah, but that's also, we should not forget it, that's also how a market economy works.
Yeah.
It's very efficient if you have a transaction and then you don't have anything to do with it, how people use it or whatever. So it's very efficient in terms of who bears the risks and the costs.
Yeah.
And to change that is a cost compared to our current model. Yeah. So if you want that producer keeps responsibility or gives a guarantee, it's a cost for the company. Mm-hmm. So it's less attractive. If you want them to recover the materials out of a product in the end of the lifetime of a product, it's a cost to the company. Mm-hmm. So it all is not as efficient as how currently the market works. So this is not a moral judgment. This is simply how it currently works.
Yeah. It reminds me of the, I think all our listeners will understand, the returning of the aluminum cans and the plastics, and you have to sometimes go to two different supermarkets before you find a machine that finally works. And it's also to the consumer a little bit less efficient. Okay, back to this example though, because it's not all just doom and gloom. There was a giant uproar, pretty big uproar against Microsoft doing this. I think maybe partially because it fell on the National E-Waste Day. So the ironics there was just too high. There was a lot of backlash and Microsoft has now extended it for another year. I think, Matsuya, at least ideally you would want till 2030, you were telling me?
Yeah, the ideal would be now, so that's about 10 years of the software support being provided, and ideally it would be 15 or more. Mm-hmm. That's what the civil society groups were pushing for, like the Right to Repair Coalition. So they really got some response from Microsoft in that it was extended by 1 year, but it's not really a huge change, as we were discussing some of these business model changes or something that would actually resolve the root of the problem, but rather it's really just kind of kicking the can down the road. Well, don't be upset about it now. Let's talk about it again in a year.
Okay, so we'll be here next year, probably.
Yeah, probably. Likely.
Okay, but what more can be done now? Not just next year or a few more years down the road. I think you'd already mentioned one of them, the right to repair. We also featured that on one of the podcast episodes previously. Can you explain a little bit more what's happening with those civil society groups or in Europe?
Yeah, with right to repair, I think that for consumers, it's good to be aware that these types of organizations exist around them, these types of repair shops and this movement to give yourself more of the product that you purchase. So those types of initiatives are around and it's good to look around for them. I also think that where possible, it's good to look for companies that are having more fundamental changes. So I mentioned Fairphone earlier. Those are the types of companies that we can support to move to more of this sustainable model.
Mattia, for our listeners, what is our right to repair currently in Europe?
Our right to repair is significantly improved compared to what it was a couple of years ago. So we definitely have, you can tell in awareness, we have a right to repair. Is it a directive or a regulation now? Excuse me, to all my ex-legal colleagues.
Yeah, but I
have to check if it's a directive or a regulation. But really, we have this legal basis for our right to repair, and there's all kinds of things becoming available there. So, you know, the availability and price of spare parts so that we can have improved access to that. There's more rules around durability. So this is in the European eco-design regulations. So there's movement happening, but there's also a lot more that can be done. So I think there's still space to improve it, but we definitely do have more of a right to repair than we did previously.
And this also applies to electronics.
Yes, I think it's notable to say that it doesn't apply to laptops. So
I was going to say, because I know another brand of a laptop at home that you cannot open up yourself and repair.
I think at the moment, the requirement to have a product be designed with the ability to repair it only applies to some household electronics, mobile phones, and a couple of dozen other items. But notably for our anecdote today, definitely not to laptops yet. So that's something that's like the next frontier of the right to repair.
Yeah.
So if we go back to plant obsolescence, some part of the solution is in the design of products.
Yeah.
So a modular retouch components. Another part is also in consumer behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Do people want to use product for longer periods?
Yeah.
Another part is in repair, like you said. And another part is in advertisement and in marketing. Is there anything going on there or nothing?
I wouldn't know.
Don't know.
Yeah, for advertising, I don't know. I was thinking more in the sphere of what we want for investors and financiers and how they can support this. So really having more of asking companies for specific types of disclosures so that you can know whether they are just telling a flashy story about the renewable energy that they're using in their data centers or whether they are really considering these life cycle approaches. So that would have been my thought. But on marketing, I wouldn't think that there's being a limitation on it to prevent this iPhone craze that's every year.
So an example would be you can only really market it as a different product if there is actually something very different on it or if it's really an improvement.
No, I was thinking, so the problem is waste in the end. It's e-waste and that's an economic or an ecological problem and might also be an economic problem to some sense. But that's also the end point of the solution. So recycling is not the solution for e-waste. It should be further up the chain, and the earlier the better. And of course, I will say we should buy less.
Yeah.
And so that's where it starts. And also in terms of legislation, you see something happening with transparency.
Mm-hmm.
And from transparency, I always say, well, that's a shallow leverage point because then we expect that consumer is going to react on what is disclosed.
Yeah.
But it's not an obligation for no one to do anything. And if we then still have forceful marketing and advertisement and...
I wonder whether we will see consumers actually responding to it because I mentioned earlier the France's law that they have on this where they have to now, producers have to show it visibly what the repair score is for a certain product. And then I think after that's been in place for a while, we'll be able to see whether it is something the consumers actually respond to.
And I think I had this discussion at home as well and because I was getting pretty angry at it. But there was also just kind of an assumption this is just the way it is. I mean, you have a new computer and of course it's going to end up being, it's going to be obsolete at the end.
But shouldn't you be the one to decide, at least have more of the opportunity to decide when it's obsolete?
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. But even with cars, with Yuri's car, so there's a plot twist to the car from 1997. Still works, still drives. He has now received a letter from the city paying him 1,000 euros to get it removed off the street.
Yeah, and then you can wonder, is that good or not good or bad?
Yeah.
Because someone decided, and is it because it is too polluting, the car? Because
yeah, that was the reason.
So that's also a reason for plant. Then, so other plot twist.
Yeah.
You can also have positive plant obsolescence if norms in society shift.
Yeah.
Like on the pollution of a car, then it's good.
And that's the innovation that happened to bring us to these cars that
Absolutely.
Are less polluting. So that's the one.
And
we
that's
want.
Why yeah. you really should have another car.
Yeah. Well, yeah. he doesn't have to get a new car. He can
I can also. But
bike.
He has to get 1,000 euros.
He can change parts of the car to fit with the new innovation, which
there
of course was not accounted for back in 97, but it's something that we could think about with future cars.
Well, older cars are sometimes easier to fix. Okay, back to away from the plot twists, back to companies. Do we know what kind of the mood is within these companies? Do you have any idea?
We had heard from our colleagues from the Right to Repair Coalition that there is a desire for this drive within the sustainability components of the sustainability teams within companies, but that it's hard to, you know, get companies to open up the purse strings when it comes to the financial aspects of this. And I think that's where we come to Hans's earlier point that when regulation is such that it becomes the financial driver as well, that these resources are more expensive, that, you know, you really need to design these products differently and with different materials, that that's when we'll see more of a change. I liked my argument that they could see it as this value of, you know, being able to get the materials back and seeing it as a positive for them as a business case. Mm-hmm. But indeed, as Hans says, I think it's a valid point. They've likely considered this and come to it that it's just not.
Yeah. But two things. On the one hand, I was thinking you're going to say regulation.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, to make it possible for a company to have a business case, we need regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And then it will be easier to get that business case right. The second part is, I think, the governance and the ownership of companies and profit incentive within companies should also be reduced to some sense to make it aligned with real economy outcomes. This is very abstract to say that they only produce useful stuff and not overproduce things that needs to be planned obsolete to get their business case right, which is crazy, but that's what we do.
Yeah, where companies are, you could say, you know, you have your investment portfolio maybe, and you have the biggest companies in there based on financials. But let's say you have some sort of investment product that has the best companies that are the most repairable or the most durable, and start ranking them like that. And you mentioned in France as well, there is the...
it's a repair score, right? So then they have to put, they have kind of where you would see the price tag of the product.
Yeah.
You can now also compare it on what is the repairability, durability, availability of spare parts. And we'll see whether it's something consumers respond to.
Yeah, but also pricing externalities. So making resources more expensive, that kind of stuff would really help to get that business case right. That's
making,
a big problem in the circular economy in general.
Making them more expensive before they become more expensive because of scarcity. So kind of as a preparation for that.
Yeah.
And this increasing transparency, one last question. Is that going to get us there, you think?
No.
No.
Okay. No, it helps. And like Matthias said, in France... they have a big experiment, and we have also to see in a few years if it works. But in terms of levers for change, it's not a big incentive because we expect people to act on new information, and it's not that we're going to tell them to do something. And also what we know from research, people react the best to price incentives.
Yeah.
So making the more durable, more sustainable stuff more of cheaper, that would really help.
And that's not the approach because it puts all the responsibility on the consumers.
Yeah.
So what can companies do more to solve this problem?
Okay, to wrap up those key questions. So we covered what planned obsolescence is. It's something that's driven by economic factors, but also by social factors. Technological innovation really helps renew products, but so does things like marketing and the financial drive of companies. Well, what are the bigger impacts to society? There's a lot of extra waste going, a lot of wasted resources, a lot of money. access to electronics as well. Oftentimes, people and individuals that are really resourceful end up getting these higher costs. It reflects a broader issue of focus on only the economic and the financial aspects and what more can be done. Quite a lot, but it should be falling more on the companies to really shift their focus away from only the financials, accounting for externalities, so costs to society, increasing the price of resources, which is going to happen at some point because resources are getting more scarce, and also regulators increasing these incentives. Whew, well
good,
done.
Good summary.
Great. Well done. I listened this time.
This time.
We've had a big conversation about this one topic. And now I'm just going to finish off with our one closing question to Mattia. If you had 10 billion euros to change the world, how would you use it?
Oh, to change the world. I thought it was about how to create impact on this topic. Okay.
Yeah, that's also
well,
okay.
I think
that's
you can change okay. the world that way too.
Yeah. I think that within the scale of that question, even now when I realize it's even bigger, 10 billion doesn't seem like that much, especially when we consider, you know, how much...
Only people in finance say that's always the same.
Oh, is it?
Everybody else thinks, that's a lot of money. Yeah. And the people working in the financial sector, no, it's only 10 billion. But go on.
Well, I have like a little bit of an angel devil thing going on here on the shoulders. Like on the angel side, it's telling me that for this topic, we really need like, you know, the enabling environment. So we need these facilities that are going to do this recovery processes and do it in as cheap as possible to make it attractive for companies. That's the good side. And then the kind of devilish side just says that we need to put it all towards lobby, you know, because I really think that the fossil industry and the linear industry has such strong lobby that I think the clean industry and the circularity aspects really need stronger voices in the room.
Great.
Good point.
Yeah, I like that. All right. Thank you, Hans. Thank you, Mattia. And thank you to the listeners. If you really liked it, then hit the subscribe button to tune in next month.
That's a wrap for this episode of Money for Change. We hope you found today's conversation insightful and inspiring as we continue to explore the transitions that are shaping our world and our future. If you enjoyed what you heard, don't forget to hit the subscribe button so you never miss an episode. Thanks for tuning in to Money for Change.